now that they're about to fire the man who built up everything surrounding them. But he stays quiet. The president throws up his hands. We're aware that David pushes hard, but he gets results. And the sponsors have made a significant investment. For God's sake, Peter, they saved us from bankruptcy. And we've got a chance to build something big now using the products of the junior team. Peter looks him in the eye for the first time and replies through gritted teeth. We're not supposed to develop products. We don't manufacture anything at all. We nurture human beings. Those guys are flesh and blood, not business plans and investment targets. The youth program isn't some factory, regardless of what some of our sponsors seem to think. He bites his lip hard and stops himself. The president scratches his stubble. They both look tired. Peter looks down at the floor again. Soon thinks David is pushing the juniors too hard. I'm concerned about what might happen if he's right, he mutters. The president smiles and shrugs his shoulders. Do you know what happens to coal if you apply enough pressure to it, Peter? It turns into diamonds. The Anderson family never plays Monopoly. Not because the parents don't want to, but because the children refuse. The last time they tried, Kira ended up holding the board over the open fire, threatening to burn it unless Peter confessed that he had been cheating. Their parents are so competitive that Maya and Leo simply refuse to play. Leo loves hockey because he loves being part of a team, but he would probably have been just as happy being in charge of the equipment as he is being a center. Maya chose the guitar. You can't compete at playing the guitar. Maya's last sporting memory is of the time she lost a game of table tennis when she was 6 because another girl ran into her and knocked her over, and how the youth group leader who was supposed to hand out the medals had to lock himself in a cleaning cupboard so Kira wouldn't find him. Maya had to console her mother all the way home. After that, she announced that she wanted to learn to play a musical instrument. Nothing has made Kira more proud or more envious than when she heard her daughter plug in an amplifier for the first time and played David Bowie in the garage with her dad on drums. She hated and loved Peter because he had the sensitivity to learn, so that he could be close to Maya. The 4 members of the family are so improbably different, and even if Kira never stops reminding them that Peter actually confessed to cheating at Monopoly, she nonetheless thinks about that Monopoly board every now and then and feels ashamed. Not a second has passed since she had children without her feeling like a bad mother. For everything. For not understanding, for being impatient, for not knowing everything, not making better packed lunches, for still wanting more out of life than just being a mother. She hears other women in Beartown sigh behind her back. Yes, but she has a full-time job, you know. Can you imagine? No matter how much you try to let words like that run off you, a few of them stick. She's ashamed to admit it to herself, but getting to work feels like a liberation. She knows she's good at her job, and she never feels that way about being a parent. Even on the best days, the tiny, shimmering moments when they're on holiday and Peter and the children are fooling about on a beach and everyone is happy and laughing, Kira always feels like a fake. As if she doesn't deserve it. As if she just wants to be able to show a photoshopped family photograph to the rest of the world. Her work may be demanding and tough, but it's straightforward and logical. And being a parent is never like that. If she does everything right at work, things usually go as planned. But it doesn't matter if she does absolutely everything in the universe correctly as a mother. The very worst can still happen. The weight on Peter's chest feels too heavy for him to be able to get up from his chair. The president tries to look authoritative. The board wants you to tell soon the news and deal with the interviews with the press. It's important that we demonstrate that we're all united regarding this decision. Peter rubs his eyebrows with his knuckles. When? Right after the juniors' final. Peter looks up in surprise. Don't you mean after the semifinal? Tomorrow? The president shakes his head calmly. No, if they lose the semifinal, David won't be getting the job. The board will select someone else instead. In which case, we'll need another couple of weeks. Peter's world wobbles on its axis. Are you kidding? You're seriously contemplating firing soon and then bringing in someone from outside? The president opens a small bag of chips eats a handful, and wipes the salt on his jacket. Come on, Peter, don't be naive. If the juniors win the final, we'll get an incredible amount of publicity. The sponsors, the council, everyone's going to want to join in. But the board isn't interested in almost. Just look at us. Look at the club. The president throws up his hands a bit too quickly, but carries on talking through the ensuing shower of crumbs. Don't be a hypocrite, Peter. You haven't devoted all those hours to this team for almost. You didn't become GM for almost. No one really cares if the guys put up a good fight. They'll only remember the final result. David is completely inexperienced as an A-team coach, but we can overlook that if he wins. But if he doesn't, well, you know the rules. Either you win, or you're an also-ran. For a long time, they just look at each other, the club president and its GM. They say nothing more, but they both know. If Peter doesn't fall into line behind the board and the sponsors, he too can be replaced. Club first. Always. He leaves the president's office, closes the door behind him, and stands forlornly in the hallway with his forehead against the wall. One harsh lesson that Peter had to learn very quickly when he became GM was that everyone was always unhappy with him. That was hard to accept for someone who has always wanted to keep people happy. It was Soon who told him not to let it bother him, and that his talent for compromise would get him a long way. Then he was able to listen and make difficult decisions with his head rather than his heart. Perhaps Soon didn't have his own dismissal in mind when he said that. Perhaps he changed his mind when he got older. Perhaps Peter himself has changed. He doesn't know. But he does know the rules. Everyone knows the rules. You're either a particular type of club, or you're one of all the rest. Not that any of this feels the slightest bit better as a result. All he knows is that he keeps disappointing people. Always. On one corner of the desk in Kira's office, there's an increasingly cramped collection of family photographs. One is of her and Peter taken the day they moved to Canada, when he'd only just gotten his NHL contract. She happens to notice it just as she's putting her briefcase down and smiles. God, they were so young then. She had only just qualified as a lawyer and was pregnant, and he was going to be a superstar. How easy everything was back then, for a few magical weeks. She stops smiling when she remembers how quickly the smiles in that picture had faded. Peter broke his foot in preseason training, and when he returned, he had to fight his way up through the farm team league, only to break his foot a second time when he was finally allowed to play again, after 4 NHL games. It took him 2 years to work his way back after that. 6 minutes into his 5th game, he fell and didn't get back up. She screamed out loud, despite swearing while she was growing up that she would never make a fool of herself or any man. She sat through 9 operations. She doesn't know how many hours of rehab, physiotherapists and specialists. All that talent, all that sweat, all leading up to nothing but tears and bitterness, and a man whose heart wanted so much more than his body could handle. She remembers when the doctor told her Peter would never be able to play at elite level again, because no one dared tell Peter directly. They had a young son at the time, and a daughter on the way. Kira had already decided that she would be called Maya. For several months, they had a dad who was present without being present. There are no former hockey players, because they never quite reach the same temperature as the rest of us. It's like trying to rehabilitate returning soldiers. They drift about aimlessly when they don't have anyone to fight with or for. The whole of Peter's life had been divided into times and schedules and bus trips and locker rooms, meals and training sessions, and even regulated times for sleep. One of the toughest concepts to teach someone like that is everyday life. There were days when Kira thought about giving up and asking for a divorce. But she remembered one of the stupid slogans written on scraps of paper all over Peter's room when he was growing up. The only time I'm not moving forward is when I'm taking aim. Peter is alone in the hallway. The door to Soon's office is closed. It's the first time in 20 years that Peter has seen it like that, and he's never been more grateful. He thinks about the words on the wall of the president's office, culture, values, community. He remembers something Soon told him during preseason training a lifetime ago. Culture is as much about what we encourage as what we permit. For Soon, the coach, that applied to making them run through the forest until they threw up, but for Soon, the man, it also applied to life. Peter gets some coffee and drinks it, even though it tastes like something has crawled into the cup and died there, then stops in front of the team photograph from their silver medal season, the club's greatest triumph. There are copies of the picture all around the building. Robbie Holtz is standing next to him in the middle row. They haven't so much as spoken to each other since Peter came back to Beartown, and hardly a day goes by without Peter wondering what life would have been like if they had changed places. If Robbie had been the more talented one, if he had gone to Canada. If Peter had stayed here and worked in the factory. How different life would have been then. He remembers one morning in Canada when Kira pulled him out of bed before the children woke up, forced him to sit and look at them as they slept. "They're your team now," she whispered over and over again, until tears from his eyes started to run down her cheeks. That year they built a new life, stayed in Canada, and fought their way through every battle that came their way. Kira got a job in a law firm. Peter worked part-time selling insurance. They made it work. They settled. And then, just as Kira started to make plans for the future, came the nights when they realized something was wrong. All through their childhood, boys are told that all they need to do is their best. That it will be enough, as long as they give their all. Peter looks himself in the eye in the photograph. He's so incredibly young. He met Kira for the first time the evening they lost that last game down in the Capitol. The fact that they'd made it as far as that was a miracle, but that wasn't good enough for Peter. For him, it was more than a game. It was a chance for a small town to show the big city that not everything can be bought. The papers in the Capitol had patronizingly decided to label the game "The Call of the Wild," and Peter had looked each of his teammates in the eye and roared, "They may have the money, but hockey belongs to us." They gave it everything they had. It wasn't enough. That evening, the team went out to celebrate winning silver. Peter sat on his own all night in a little family-run restaurant next to the hotel. Kira was behind the bar. Peter broke down in tears in front of her, not for his own sake, but because he wouldn't be able to look his town in the eye again. Because he'd let them all down. It was a pretty weird first date, but he's able to smile about it in hindsight. "What was it?" she said to him. "Have you ever considered not feeling so sorry for yourself?" That made him laugh, and he didn't stop for several days. He's fallen for her every day since then. And once, a long time afterward, when Kira had been drinking and was a bit too loud, the way she gets after too much wine, she held his ears so tightly that he genuinely thought they were going to come off, and when he lowered his head to hers, she whispered, "You adorable, stupid idiot. Don't you realize that's when I fell in love with you? You were a lost little kid from the backwoods. But I knew that someone who was second best in the country but was still crying because he was worried about disappointing the people he loved, that person was going to turn out to be a good man. He'd be a good father. He'd protect his children. He'd never let anything happen to his family." Kira remembers every inch of the descent into darkness. The greatest terror of every parent, waking up and listening out for small breaths. And every night you feel so foolish when you hear them, as usual, for worrying about nothing. "How did I become someone like this?" you think. You promise yourself that you'll relax, because of course you know that nothing's going to happen. But the following night, you still lie there wide awake, staring up at the ceiling and shaking your head until you tell yourself, "Just tonight, then." And you creep out of bed and put your palms to your children's little chests to feel them rising and falling. And then one night, one of them falls and doesn't rise again as strongly. And then you fall. All the hours in the waiting room at the hospital, all the nights on the floor beside the boy's bed, that morning when the doctor told Peter because no one dared tell Kira. They simply fell. If they hadn't had Maya, would they have been able to go on living? How does anyone do that? Kira was so pleased when they moved away. She could never imagine that she would feel so happy to move back. But they could start again there, she and Peter and Maya. And then Leo came along. They were happy, or at least as happy as a family can be when it's burdened by a grief too large to be absorbed by time. But Kira still doesn't know how to deal with it. Peter puts his hand on the glass of the frame. Kira never stopped making his pulse throb in his throat. He still loves her the way you do when you're a teenager, when your heart swells in your chest and makes you feel like you can't breathe. But she had been wrong. He couldn't protect his family. And not a single day goes by without him wondering what he could have done differently. Could he have made a deal with God? If he had sacrificed all his talent, given up all his success, his own life? What would God have given him in exchange? Could he have changed places in the coffin with his firstborn son? At night, Kira still goes around the house, counting their children. 1, 2, 3. 2 in their beds, 1 in heaven. Chapter 10. Say what you like about Beartown. It can take your breath away. When the sun rises above the lake, when the mornings are so cold that the oxygen itself is crisp, when the trees seem to bow respectfully over the ice in order to let as much light as possible reach the children playing on it, then you can't help wondering how anyone could choose to live in places where all you can see are concrete and buildings. 4-year-olds play outdoors on their own here, and there are still people who have never locked their front doors. After Canada, Maya's parents were overprotective to a degree that might have appeared a bit unusual, even in a big city, so in Beartown it seemed almost psychotic. There's something very peculiar about growing up in the shadow of a dead older brother. Children in that situation become either terrified of everything or nothing at all. Maya fell into the second group. She parts from Anna in the hallway with their secret handshake. They were in their first year at school when Anna came up with it, but Maya was the one who realized that the only way to keep it secret was to do it so quickly that no one had time to see the different elements. Fist up, fist down, palm, palm, butterfly, bent finger, pistols, jazz hands, mini rocket, explosion, ass to ass, out bitches. Anna came up with the descriptions. Maya still laughs every time they bang their backsides together at the end, and Anna turns her back on her, throwing her hands up in the air and yelling, "And Anna is out, bitches," and walks away. But she doesn't do it as loudly anymore, not when they're at school, not when other people can see her. She pulls her arms in, lowers her voice, tries to fit in. Throughout their childhood, Maya loved her best friend because she wasn't like any other girl she had met. But life as a teenager seems to have acted like sandpaper on Anna. She's getting smoother and smoother, smaller and smaller. Sometimes Maya misses her. Kira looks at the time, pulls some papers from her briefcase, and hurries off to a meeting, then straight on to another one. She's running late as usual as she hurries back to her office, already behind schedule. There's a label she used to love, but which she loathes when it's pronounced in a Beartown accent. Career woman. Peter's friends call her that, some in admiration and some with distaste, but no one calls Peter a career man. It strikes a nerve because Kira recognizes the insinuation. You have a job so you can provide for your family, whereas a career is selfish. You have one of those for your own sake. So now she's dangling somewhere between two worlds and feels just as guilty when she's in the office as she does when she's at home. Everything has become a compromise. When she was young, she used to dream about criminal trials and dramatic courtroom showdowns. But the reality now is agreements, contracts, settlements, meetings, and emails, emails, emails. "You're overqualified for this," her boss told her when she got the job, as if she had any choice. Her qualifications and skills could have given her a 6-figure salary in plenty of places around the world, but this is the only major law firm within commuting distance of Beartown. Their clients are forestry companies and council-run partnerships. The work is often monotonous, rarely stimulating, yet always stressful. Sometimes she thinks to their time in Canada and what all the hockey coaches there kept banging on about. They wanted the right kind of guy for their team. Not just someone who could play, but someone who fit into the locker room, who didn't cause problems, who did his job. Someone who played hard and kept quiet. She wonders what it would take for a woman to be the right kind of guy. Her train of thought is interrupted by a colleague, Kira's best work friend and the antidote to the sickness of boredom. I've never been so hungover. My mouth tastes like an ashtray. You didn't see me lick one last night, did you? I wasn't with you last night, Kira says with a smile.
Weren't you? Are you sure? After work drinks. You were, weren't you? It was after work drinks, wasn't it?
Her colleague mutters, dropping onto a chair. She's over 6 feet tall and carries every inch with pride. Instead of trying to shrink when faced with insecure men in the office, she shows up in blood-red shoes with heels as sharp as army knives and the height of Cuban cigars. She's a comic book artist's fantasy. No one dominates a room the way she does. Or a party.
What are you doing?
She asks.
Work. What are you doing? Kira counters.
Her colleague waves one hand and holds the other over her eyes as if trying to pretend it's a chilled towel.
I'll do some work in a minute.
I need to get this finished before lunch, Kira sighs, bending over her papers. Her colleague leans forward and scans the documents. It would have taken a normal person a month to grasp all that. You're too good for this firm. You know that, don't you? She always says she envies Kira's brain. In return, Kira is envious of her colleague's middle finger, which gets regular use. Kira smiles wearily.
What is it you usually say?
Stop whining, shut up, and send the invoice, her colleague says with a grin.
Stop whining, shut up, and send the invoice, Kira repeats.
The two women lean across the table and high-five each other. A teacher is standing in a classroom, trying to get a group of 17-year-old boys to be quiet. Jeanette is having one of those mornings when she asks herself why she puts herself through this, not just teaching, but Beartown itself. She raises her voice, but the boys at the back aren't even ignoring her on purpose. She's quite convinced that they genuinely haven't noticed she's there. There are other pupils in the class who want more than this, but they're invisible, inaudible. They just lower their heads and close their eyes tightly and hope that the hockey season will soon be over. One of the plainest truths about both towns and individuals is that they usually don't turn into what we tell them to be, but what they are told they are. The teacher has always been told she's too young for this, too attractive, that they won't respect her. Those boys have been told that they're bears, winners, immortal. Hockey wants them that way, needs them that way. Their coach teaches them to go hard into close combat on the ice. No one stops to think about how to switch that attitude off when they leave the locker room. It's easier to pin the blame on her. She's too young, too attractive, too easily offended, too difficult to respect. In a final attempt to get control of the situation, the teacher turns to the team captain. He's sitting in a corner tapping at his phone. She says his name. He doesn't react.
Kevin,
she repeats. He raises an eyebrow.
Yes, how can I help you, my lovely?
The juniors around him laugh as if on command.
Are you actually following what I'm teaching you here? It's going to be on the exam, she says.
I already know it, Kevin replies.
It irritates her intensely that he doesn't say this provocatively or aggressively. His voice is as neutral as a weather forecaster's.
Really? You already know it? She snorts. I've read the book. You're just telling us the same things it says there. My phone could do your job. The juniors roar with laughter so loudly that the windows rattle. And then, of course, Bobo sees his chance, the biggest and most predictable boy in the school, always ready to kick someone who's already down.
Just calm down, sweet cheeks, he yells.
What did you call me?
She snaps, then realizes that's exactly the response he wants.
It's a compliment. I love sweets.
Howls of laughter wash over her.
Sit down!
Just calm down now, sweet cheeks. I said you should be proud.
Proud?
Yes, in a couple of weeks' time, you'll be able to go around telling everyone you meet that you once taught the legendary junior team who brought the gold back to Beartown.
A large part of the class roars its approval, hands banging radiators, feet stamping the floor.
She knows it's too late even to try to raise her voice now. She's already lost. Bobo stands up on his desk like a cheerleader and sings, "We are the Bears! We are the Bears! We are the Bears! The Bears from Beartown!" The other juniors leap up onto their desks and join in. By the time the teacher leaves the classroom, they're all standing bare-chested, chanting, "The Bears from Beartown!" All apart from Kevin, who just sits there quietly looking at his phone, as calm as if he were alone in a dimly lit room. In Kira's office, her colleague runs her tongue back and forth across her teeth in disgust. "Seriously, it feels like I've eaten someone's toupee. You don't think I could have ended up sleeping with that guy in accounting, do you? I was planning to sleep with the other one, whatever his job is. The one with the tight buns and scruffy hair." Kira laughs. Her colleague is single to the extreme, whereas Kira is fanatically monogamous. The lone she-wolf and the mother hen, doomed to envy each other. Her colleague lowers her voice to ask, "Okay, who would you pick from the office, if you had to pick one?" "Not this again. I know, you're married. But if your husband was dead..." "Hello?" "Christ, it's hardly that sensitive. Okay, if he was sick, or in a coma. Better, who would you sleep with if your husband was in a coma?" "No one," Kira hisses. "If the survival of the human race depended on it, the guy with the buns and the hair, right? Not the badger, surely." "Remind me, which one's the badger?" Her colleague does what Kira has to admit is a fairly impressive impression of a man who has recently been appointed to management and happens to bear a striking resemblance to a badger. Kira laughs so hard she almost knocks her coffee over. "Don't be mean to him. He's a nice guy." "So are pigs, so we don't let them inside the house." Her colleague hates the badger, not as an individual, but for what he represents. He got a position in management even though everyone knows it should have gone to Kira. It's a subject Kira tries to avoid discussing, seeing as she can't bring herself to tell her friend the truth. Kira was offered the job, but turned it down. It would have meant too much work in the evenings, too much traveling. She couldn't do that to her family. And now she's sitting here, not daring to tell her colleague because she doesn't want to see the disappointment in her eyes. That Kira was offered the chance, but didn't take it. Her colleague bites off a broken nail and spits it out into the waste paper basket. "Have you seen the way he looks at women? The badger? Those beady little eyes. I bet you 1,000 kroner he's the sort who'd want you to shove a pen up..." "I'm trying to work," Kira interrupts. Her colleague looks genuinely baffled. "What? It's an objective observation. I have extensive experience on the subject of markers, but fine. Sit on your high horse and pretend you're morally untouchable just because your husband's in a coma." "You're still drunk, aren't you?" Kira says, laughing. "Does he like that sort of thing? Peter? Pens?" "No!" Her colleague apologizes at once, sounding upset. "Sorry, is that a sensitive subject? Have you argued about it?" Kira hustles her out of her office. She hasn't got time for any more laughter today. She's got a schedule to stick to, or at least try to. Then one of the bosses comes along and asks if she's got time to take a quick look at a contract, which swallows an hour. A client rings with an urgent problem, which takes another hour. Leo rings and says his training session has been brought forward half an hour because the junior team needs more time on the ice, so she'll have to get home earlier this afternoon. Maya calls and asks her mom to buy new strings for her guitar on the way home. Peter sends a text saying he'll be late home tonight. Her boss comes in again and asks if Kira has time for a quick meeting. She doesn't. She goes anyway. Trying to be the right kind of guy. Even if it's impossible to be the right kind of mom at the same time. Maya can still remember the first time she met Anna. They held hands before they saw each other's faces. Maya was 6 years old and was out skating on the lake on her own, something her parents would never have allowed, but they were at work and the babysitter had dozed off in an armchair. So Maya grabbed her skates and sneaked out. Perhaps she was looking for danger. Perhaps she simply trusted that an adult hand would catch her before anything went wrong. Perhaps she was just like most children, born to seek out adventure. Dusk fell sooner than she was expecting. She didn't see the change in the color of the ice.
and when it gave way beneath her, the water paralyzed her before she even had time to feel frightened. She didn't stand a chance. 6 years old, with no crampons or studs, and her arms so cold that she could barely cling on to the edge. She was already dead. Say what you like about Beartown, but it can take your breath away in a single second. She saw Anna's hand long before she saw Anna. How 1 6-year-old girl managed to pull out another girl the same age, weighed down by a soaking wet snowsuit, Maya will never understand. But that's what Anna was like. You can't keep two girls apart after a thing like that. Anna, a child of nature who went hunting and fishing but didn't quite understand people, ended up best friends with Maya, who was the exact opposite. The first time Maya was over at Anna's and heard her parents arguing, she understood that Anna was on thin ice in ways all her own. Anna has spent more nights at Maya's than at home ever since. They came up with their secret handshake to remind each other that it was always sisters before misters, which Anna used to repeat like a mantra before she even knew what the words meant. She took every chance she got to nag Maya about fishing or hunting or climbing trees. It used to drive Maya crazy, seeing as she would much rather be at home playing her guitar, preferably next to a radiator. But God, she loved Anna. Anna was a tornado, a jagged, hundred-sided peg in a community where everyone was supposed to fit into round holes. When they were 10 years old, she taught Maya to shoot a hunting rifle. Maya remembers that Anna's dad always hid the key to his gun cabinet in a box on top of a cupboard at the back of the cellar that stank of mold. Apart from keys and a couple of bottles of vodka, the box was also full of porn magazines. Maya stared at them in shock. Anna noticed and simply shrugged her shoulders. Dad doesn't understand how the internet works. They stayed in the forest until the ammunition ran out. Then Anna, who always had a knife with her, made swords for them both out of tree limbs, and they fenced among the trees until it got dark. Now Maya watches her friend walk off down the corridor, sees her pull her arms down as if she's embarrassed, without even daring to yell, "Out!" because all she dreams about these days is being as normal as possible. Maya hates being a teenager, hates sandpaper, hates round holes, misses the girl who pretended to be a knight in the forest. We become what we are told we are. Anna has always been told that she's wrong. Benji is slumped so low on his cushion in the headmaster's office that there's more of him on the floor than on the chair. They're going through the motions. The headmaster has to tell him off for being late so often this term when all he really wants to talk about is hockey, like everyone else. Any thought of expulsion or other disciplinary measures is out of the question. From time to time, Benji thinks about his eldest sister, Audrey, the one with the kennels. The further the juniors have progressed in the tournament, the more Benji has realized how similar he is to the dogs. If you make yourself useful, you get a longer leash. They hear Jeanette long before she storms through the door. "Those animals! Those... I can't bear it anymore!" she roars before she's even entered the room. "Calm down now, sweet cheeks," Benji says with a smile, and is quite convinced that she's going to punch him. "Say that again! Say that one more time, and I swear you won't be able to play in that game!" she roars at him with her hand raised. The headmaster lets out an anxious yelp and flies up from his chair, takes her by the arm, and leads her out into the corridor. Perhaps grabbing someone's arm is the correct response, but both Benji and the teacher know that it should have been Benji's. In a classroom farther down the corridor, Bobo slips off his desk and tumbles to the floor, still bare-chested and in the middle of the bears from Beartown. There are two types of 17-year-olds around him, those who like hockey and those who hate it, the ones who are terrified that he's hurt himself and those who hope he has. Chapter 11. A simple truth, repeated as often as it is ignored, is that if you tell a child it can do absolutely anything, or that it can't do anything at all, you will in all likelihood be proven right. Lars has no leadership style. He just yells. Amit has had him as his coach throughout his time on the boys' team, and there are a few things that worry him more than David being given the job of coaching the A-team next season, so that Lars ends up in charge of the junior team just as Ahmet gets there. 2 more years with this man is more than he could handle, even for the sake of hockey. Lars has no grasp of tactics or technique. He just thinks everything is warfare. His only pep talk is bellowing that they have to win the battle for the fortress, and that they mustn't get fucked up the ass. If the 15-year-olds had been clutching axes in their hands instead of hockey sticks, he would have coached them in exactly the same way. Obviously, it's much worse for the others on the team. You can get away with a lot when you're the best, and that's what Ahmet has become this season. Zacharias has had to suffer one of Lars's patented saliva fountains as he yells, "Are the scars from your sex change itching, Zach?" But Ahmet has sailed through. When he thinks about how close he came to giving up completely 12 months ago, he isn't sure if he should feel happy that he carried on or aghast at how close he came to not doing so. He was tired, that's all he can remember. Tired of fighting, tired of everyone shouting at him, tired of dealing with so much crap and abuse, tired of the locker room, where the juniors snuck in during one training session to cut up his shoes and throw his clothes in the shower. Tired of trying to prove he was more than the things they called him, a zero from the hollow, the cleaner's son, too small, too weak. One evening after training, he went home and didn't get out of bed for 4 days. His mom very patiently left him alone. Only on the 5th morning did she open his door, ready to go to work, and say, "You might be playing with bears, but that doesn't mean you have to forget that you're a lion." When she kissed him on the forehead and put her hand on his heart, he whispered, "It's too hard, Mom. Your dad would have been so proud if he could have seen you play." "Dad probably didn't even know what hockey was," he mumbled. "That's why," she replied in a raised voice. And she was a woman who took great pride in the fact that she never raised her voice. She'd managed to clean the stands and the corridor and office, and had reached the locker room that morning when the caretaker walked past and knocked gently on the doorframe. When she looked up, he nodded toward the ice and smiled. Ahmet had put down his gloves, hat, and jacket between the lines. That was the morning the boy realized that the only way to become better than the Bears at their own game was to stop playing it their way. David is sitting at the top of the stands. Now 32, he's spent more of that time inside rinks than outside them. When David became a coach, soon forced him to watch every A-team game for an entire season from up here in the nosebleed seats, and now it's a habit he can't shake. Hockey looks different from up here. And the truth is that Soon and David always saw eye to eye about the questions, they just didn't agree on the answers. Soon wanted to keep all the players in their own age group as long as possible, so that they would have time to work on their weaknesses and form rounded, focused teams without any shortcomings. David thought that attitude only led to the creation of teams where no one was exceptional. Soon believed that a player who was allowed to play with older players would only play to his strengths, and David agreed. He just couldn't see the problem with that. He didn't want a whole troop of players who were all pretty good at exactly the same things. He wanted specialists. Soon was like Beartown, a firm adherent of the old faith that no tree should grow too tall, naively convinced that hard work was enough. That's why the club has collapsed at the same rate that unemployment in the town has rocketed. Good workers aren't enough on their own. Someone needs to have big ideas as well. Collectives only work if they're built around stars. There are plenty of men in this club who think that everything in hockey should be the way it's always been. Whenever he hears that, David feels like rolling himself up in a carpet and screaming until his vocal cords give out. As if hockey has ever been constant. When it was invented, you weren't even allowed to pass the puck forward. And 2 generations ago, everyone played without a helmet. Hockey is like every other living organism. It has to adapt and evolve, or else it will die. David can no longer remember how many years he has been arguing about this with Soon, but on the evenings when he gets home in his very blackest mood, his girlfriend usually teases him, asking if he's fallen out with Daddy again. It was quite funny to start with. Soon was more than just a coach when David himself became one. He was a role model.
The end of a hockey player's career is an endless series of doors closing with you on the wrong side, and David couldn't have lived without a team, without feeling he was part of something. When injury forced him off the ice at the age of 22, Soon was the only person who understood that. Soon taught David to be a coach at the same time as he was teaching Peter to be GM. In a lot of ways, they're each other's opposite. David could get into an argument with a door, and Peter was so averse to conflict that he couldn't even kill time. Soon hoped they'd complement each other, but they've developed a mutual loathing instead. For years, David's deepest shame was the fact that he could never get over the jealousy he felt whenever Soon and Peter would go into Peter's office without inviting him along. His love of the camaraderie of the sport was grounded in a fear of exclusion. So eventually he did what all ambitious pupils do to their teachers. He rebelled. He was 22 when he began coaching this group of 7-year-old boys, Kevin, Benji, and Bobo among them. He has been coaching them for 10 years now, melding them into one of the best junior teams in the whole country, and he has finally realized that he can no longer stay loyal to Soon. The players are more important. The club is bigger than that. David knows what people in the town are going to say when he gets Soon's job. He knows a lot of them aren't going to be happy, but they're going to like the results. Lars blows his whistle to signal the end of the practice so close to Zacharias's ear that the boy trips over his own stick. Lars grins unkindly. "And worst in training today was, as usual, little Miss Zach. So you get the honor of collecting the pucks and cones." Lars leaves the ice with the rest of the boys' team trailing behind him. A few of them laugh at Zacharias and he tries to give them the finger, but it's surprisingly hard to do that when you're wearing hockey gloves. Amit has already started circling the ice to gather the pucks. Their friendship has always been like that. As long as Zacharias is left on the ice, Amit doesn't leave. Once Lars is out of sight, Zacharias gets angrily to his feet and mimics the coach's exaggeratedly forward-leaning style of skating as he scratches himself hard between the buttocks. "Collect the pucks! Defend the fortress! Don't get fucked up the ass! No ass fucking on my ice! Hold on, what the... what's this? In my ass? Is it a fuck? Is it a little fuck? There's a little fuck in my ass, Amit! I order you to get it out at once!" He tries to reverse into Amit, who slips nimbly out of the way, laughing, leaving Zach to back straight into the open team bench and land in a heap. "Do you want to stay and watch the juniors practice?" Amit wonders, even though he knows Zach would never do that of his own accord. "Stop saying juniors when you mean watch Kevin. I know he's your idol, Amit, but I have actually got a life. Carpe diem. Laughter and love." Amit sighs. "Fine, forget it." "Is that Kevin Erdahl in your ass, Amit?" Zacharias cries. Amit taps his stick restlessly on the ice. "Do you want to do something this weekend, then?" He really does try to make the question sound nonchalant, as if he hadn't actually been thinking about it all day. Zacharias gets up from the bench with the body language of a baby elephant that's been shot with a tranquilizer dart. "I've got 2 new games, but you'll have to bring your own handset, seeing as you broke my other one last time." Amit looks offended by his friend's recollection of events, given that he had broken the handset with his forehead when Zacharias threw it at him in a fit of temper because he was losing. He clears his throat and collects the last of the pucks. "I just thought we could go out." Zacharias looks as if his friend has suggested pouring poison in each other's ears. "Go out where?" "Just out. People go out. That's what they do."
"You mean Maya does?"
"I mean people." Zacharias gets up on his skates and starts dancing on tiptoe and singing, "Amit and Maya sitting in a tree. Amit squirts her with his seed." Amit slaps a puck hard into the boards beside him, but can't help laughing. David is standing with Lars in the corridor outside the locker room.
"It's a mistake," Lars insists.
"However unlikely it might sound, I heard you the first 12 times. Go and get the juniors ready for practice," David replies coldly. Lars lumbers off. David massages his temples. Lars isn't an entirely useless assistant coach. David can put up with the shouting and swearing because that's part of locker room culture, and dear God, some of the guys on the team do need a tyrant at practice to make sure they actually put the pads on the right parts of their body. But sometimes David can't help wondering how the junior team will function if Lars is going to take charge of it. The man knows no more about hockey than the average noisy fan in the stands, and David could go out into the street, throw a stone, and whatever he hit that had a pulse would know as much as them. Ahmed and Zach are laughing as they approach, but fall silent abruptly when they catch sight of David. The boys squeeze against the wall so as not to get in his way. Ahmed visibly starts when David holds up his hand.
Ahmed, isn't it?
Ahmed nods. We were just collecting the pucks. We were only messing about. I mean, I know Zach was imitating Lars, but it was only a... David looks baffled. Ahmed gulps.
Actually, well, if you didn't see anything, then it was nothing.
David smiles. I've seen you sitting in the stands during the junior team's training sessions. You've been there more often than some of the players.
Ahmed nods nervously. Sorry, I just want to learn.
That's good. I know you've been studying Kevin's moves. He's a good example. You ought to check out how he always looks at the defenseman's skates in any one-on-one situation. As soon as they angle their skates and shift their center of gravity, Kevin taps the puck and makes his move.
Ahmed nods dumbly.
David is looking him right in the eye, and the boy isn't used to adult men doing that.
Anyone can see that you're fast, but you need to practice your shooting. Practice waiting for the goalie to move, shoot against the flow. Can you learn that, do you think?
Ahmed nods. David slaps him hard on the shoulder. Good. Learn it fast, because you're training with the juniors in a quarter of an hour. Go into the locker room and get a jersey.
Ahmet's hand moves instinctively toward one ear, as if he needs to clean it out to make sure he hasn't misheard.
David has already walked off. Zacharias waits until the coach has swung around the corner before wrapping his arms around his friend's neck. Ahmet is hyperventilating. Zacharias clears his throat.
Seriously, though, Ahmet. If you had to choose between sleeping with Maya and sleeping with Kevin, you'd pick...
Shut up, Ahmed says, laughing.
I'm just checking,
Zacharias grins and pats him on his helmet and growls.
Kill them, my friend. Kill them.
Ahmed takes a breath as deep as the lake behind the rink, then for the first time walks past the boys' team's locker room and steps across the threshold into the juniors. He is met instantly by a hurricane of booing and swearing and a chorus of, "Get out of here, you fucking maggot!" from the older players. But when David emerges from the hallway, a silence so complete settles that you could hear a jockstrap drop. David nods to Lars, and Lars reluctantly tosses a jersey at Ahmet. It stinks. Ahmet has never been happier. Standing outside in the hallway is his best friend. There are no almosts in ice hockey. Chapter 12. A long marriage is complicated. So complicated, in fact, that most people in one sometimes ask themselves, am I still married because I'm in love? Or just because I can't be bothered to let anyone else get to know me this well again. Kira knows that her complaining drives Peter mad, that he sometimes feels browbeaten. Sometimes she calls him 5 times a day simply to check that he's done something he promised to do. Peter's office is perfectly organized, the desk so clean you could eat off it. The shelves are lined with LPs that he doesn't dare take home because he's worried Kira will force him either to throw them away or buy a bigger house. He orders them online and has them delivered to the rink, effectively turning the receptionist into his dealer. Some people hide the fact that they smoke from their spouse. Peter hides his online shopping. He buys the records because they calm him down. They remind him of Isak. He's never told her that. Kira can't remember exactly how old the children were when the snowstorm hit, but they hadn't been living in Beartown long enough for her to get used to the forces of nature. It was around Christmas, the children weren't at school, but there was a crisis at work, so Kira had to go off to an important meeting. Peter took Maya and Leo out tobogganing,
and Kira stood by the car and watched them disappear into the swirling whiteness. It was so beautiful and so ominous at the same time. She felt so bereft once they had vanished from sight that she cried all the way to the office. When Peter got injured in Canada and Kira started work, Peter was left at home alone with Isak. One day the child had a stomachache and wouldn't stop screaming. Panic-stricken, Peter tried everything. He rocked him and took him out in the stroller and tried all the home remedies he had ever heard of, but nothing worked. Until he put a record on. Perhaps it was something about the old record player, the crackle in the speakers, the voices filling the room. But Isak fell completely silent. Then he smiled. And then he fell asleep in Peter's arms. That's the last time Peter can remember really feeling like a good father. The last time he had been able to tell himself that he actually knew what he was doing. He's never told Kira that. Has never told anyone. But now he buys records in secret because he keeps hoping that feeling might come back, if only for a moment. After her meeting that morning close to Christmas, Kira called Peter. He didn't answer. The man who otherwise always answers. Then she heard on the radio that the snowstorm had hit the forest and people were being advised to stay indoors. She called 1,000 times, left shouted messages for him, no response. She threw herself in the car and drove with her foot to the floor, even though she could barely see a yard in front of the hood. She ran out into the trees where they had left her that morning and started yelling hysterically, then collapsed and dug desperately at the snow with her hands as if she might find her children there. Her ears and fingertips froze, and afterward, she didn't know how to explain what had happened inside her. Only several years later did she realize that it was a nervous breakdown. 10 minutes later, her phone rang. It was Peter and the children, carefree and untroubled, wondering where she was. "Where are you?" she yelled. "At home," they replied, their mouths full of ice cream and cinnamon buns. When Kira asked why, Peter replied uncomprehendingly, "There was a snowstorm, so we came home." He had forgotten to charge his phone. It was in a drawer in the bedroom. Kira has never told him, has never told anyone. But she's never really recovered from that snowstorm. From the feeling she had in the car that she'd lost them, too. So now she sometimes calls her husband and children several times a day just to complain to them. To reassure herself that they're still there. Peter puts a record on, but today it doesn't help. He can't stop thinking about soon. The same thoughts keep going around his head for hours as he stares at a dark computer screen and throws a small rubber ball harder and harder against the wall. When his phone rings, the interruption is so welcome that he even forgets to be annoyed at his wife for always taking it for granted that he's going to forget everything he's promised to do. "Did he drop the car off at the garage?" she asks, even though she can already hear the answer. "Yes, of course I did," Peter says, with the absolute conviction he only demonstrates when he's lying. "How did you get to the office, then?" she asks. "How do you know I'm at the office?" "I can hear you bouncing that stupid ball against the wall." He sighs. "You ought to work as a lawyer or something. Has anyone ever told you that?" The lawyer laughs. "I'll consider it if I can't go professional with rock, paper, scissors." "You're a cheat."
"You're a liar."
Peter's voice is shaking when he suddenly whispers, "I love you so much." Kira laughs so he won't hear her crying when she answers.
"Same here."
They both hang up. Kira is eating lunch 4 hours late in front of her computer, so she can get her work done and still have time to stop to buy new guitar strings for Maya before she rushes home to take Leo to his evening practice. Peter isn't eating at all. He doesn't want to give his body the chance to throw up again. A long marriage is complicated. The juniors' locker room is quieter than usual. The significance of tomorrow's game has started to get under their skin. William Litt, who's just turned 18 but has a beard as thick as an otter's coat and weighs as much as a small car, leans toward Kevin and whispers in a voice that suggests he's in a prison film and is asking for a knife made out of a toothbrush,
"Have you got any chewing tobacco?"
On one occasion last season, David happened to mention to Lars that he had read that a single portion of chewing tobacco did more damage to a person's fitness than a whole case of beer. Since then, the juniors have been able to count on being yelled at so hard by both Lars and their parents that their hairline shifts backward if anyone so much as glimpses the telltale signs of wear on the pocket of their jeans from carrying a puck-shaped can of chewing tobacco.
No, Kevin replies.
Lit nods gratefully anyway, then sets off around the locker room in search of some. They play in the first line together, but no matter how much bigger and stronger Lit is, Kevin has always been the obvious leader. Benji, who could perhaps be described as having certain issues with authority figures, is lying half asleep on the floor, but reaches for a stick and pokes Kevin in the stomach with it.
What the?
Kevin snarls.
Give me some chewing tobacco, Benji asks. Are you deaf? I just said I've run out.
Benji just lies there calmly on the floor looking at Kevin, poking him in the stomach with the stick until Kevin snatches it from him, reaches for his jacket, and fishes out an almost full can of chewing tobacco.
When are you going to learn that you can't lie to me? Benji smiles.
When are you going to start buying your own chewing tobacco? Kevin replies.
Probably around the same time.
Lit returns without any chewing tobacco. He nods cheerily at Kevin.
Are your parents coming to the game tomorrow? My mom's bought tickets for pretty much all my relatives.
Kevin says nothing and starts to wrap tape around his stick. Benji sees this out of the corner of his eye and knows exactly what it means, so he turns to Lit and grins.
Sorry to disappoint you, Lit, but your family comes to your games to see Kevin play.
The room bursts into mocking laughter, and Kevin is spared having to say if his parents are coming to the game. Apart from the fact that Benji never has his own tobacco, it would be hard to find a better friend. Amit is sitting in a corner, doing his very best imitation of an empty corner. As the youngest in the locker room, the maggot, he has good reason to be terrified of attracting attention. He keeps his gaze focused high to avoid eye contact, but still have time to react if anyone throws something at him. The walls of the locker room are covered with posters bearing slogans. Train hard, win easy. Team before individual. We play for the bear on the front of our jerseys, not the name on the back. A recent edition with extra large print right in the middle says, We're bad losers, because a good loser is someone who's used to losing. Amit's concentration wanders for a moment, and a little too late he sees Bobo walking across the floor. When the junior back leans his substantial bulk over him, Amit disappears into his shadow and waits for Bobo to hit him, but instead Bobo smiles, which is much worse.
You'll have to excuse the guys here. They haven't been brought up properly, you know.
Amit blinks hard, unsure how to respond. Bobo clearly enjoys this and turns solemnly to the rest of the players, who are now silent and expectant. Bobo points angrily to the pieces of tape littering the floor.
Look at this mess. Well, is this how it's supposed to look? Do you think your mothers work here or something?
The juniors grin. Bobo marches around demonstratively picking up pieces of tape until they fill his cupped hands. Then he holds them up toward the ceiling like a newborn child and proclaims,
Guys, you need to remember that Amit's mother works here.
He meets the newcomer's gaze, smiles, and says,
It's Amit's mother who works here, guys.
The pieces of tape hang in the air for a moment before raining down like small, sharp projectiles over the boy in the corner. Bobo's warm breath hits his ear as he commands,
Can you give your mom a call, Maggot? It really is very messy in here.
The locker room empties in 10 seconds flat when Lars bellows,
Time!
Kevin hangs back till last. He passes Amit, who's on his knees gathering together the pieces of tape.
It's only teasing, Kevin tells him without a trace of sympathy.
Sure. Only teasing, Amit repeats quietly.
You know that girl, Maya, don't you?
Kevin says quickly on his way out through the door, as if it had only just occurred to him. Amit looks up. He's watched every single junior training session this season. Things never just occur to Kevin. Everything he ever does is carefully considered and planned. Yes, Amit mumbles.
Has she got a boyfriend?
The answer is slow coming. Kevin taps the end of his stick expectantly on the floor. Amit stares down at his hands for a long time before his head finally and reluctantly moves a few inches from side to side. Kevin nods with satisfaction and walks out toward the ice.